Power. That's a man's word. Whether you're talking about trucks or tools, cars or computers, guns or gadgets, it's all about the power. The biggest, the baddest, the best, it's all about power. You can almost hear the echoes of Tim the Toolman Taylor. Talking about power. You know that power, that quest for power, has infiltrated the church as well. Today, power is in. There's power evangelism, power prayer, power preaching, power healing, power encounters, power ministry of every shape and size. There's even power ties and available colors for power preachers to wear on power days. No, I don't have any of those, by the way. This word power can be understood in two ways: the ability to do something or the authority to do something. We use that term power in both of those contexts. The first speaks of strength and muscle, while the second refers to the right or the position. Athletes may strive for the first kind of power, the ability, while those in politics or business, and sadly some churches, look for that second kind of power, the authority to do something. You don't have to have one to have the other. I have seen big muscle-bound men be brought down to size by a little woman that they call mom. She didn't have the physical strength to subdue him, but she had the authority. It's that second type of power, the power of authority, that forms the focus of our message today. In John 19, verse 10, we see actually a couple of questions that Pilate asks Jesus. And it is the second one that's going to be our focus today. In John 19, 10, Pilate says to Jesus, "Do you refuse to speak to me? Don't you realize I have power either to free you or to crucify you?" I want to begin with what I'm calling the delusion of human autonomy. In some ways, Pilate was the picture of power in the first century. He had the political power of being appointed by the Roman emperor as governor of Judea. And with that came some certain advantages. High officials in the empire and some members of the Senate were privileged to join an elite group called the Amici Caesaris, Friends of Caesar. And when you joined this group, you got a ring to wear. You were allowed into special occasions with the emperor that were closed off to the general public. And you had certain advantages that came your way. The Jews knew that about Pilate, and actually they used that against him. You may have heard in the scripture reading this morning where the Jews said, "If you let this man go, you will no longer be a friend of Caesar." That didn't just mean you wouldn't be buddy-buddy with the emperor anymore. That means you would lose your place in the club. And there aren't many former friends of Caesar that lived to tell about it. Usually if you lost your membership, you either lost your life or you lost everything you owned and were exiled to a far-off land. The Jews used that as a tool against Pilate. But he was a member of that group. Not only did he have political power, but because he had the Roman soldiers around him, he had military power to enforce the law and to protect himself if necessary. His position gave him judicial power. He had the authority to hear cases and pronounce guilt or innocence. And when someone was found guilty, he could pronounce a sentence on them that could even be a sentence of death. He had that authority to do that. So when Pilate says to Jesus, "Don't you realize I have power?" He's practically throwing that in his face. He's bragging about it. He's saying, "I have the power, basically, of life and death in my hands." Now we might wonder, what would have led Pilate to ask that question? My guess is that when you read the tone of Pilate's words, you get a tinge of anger. Don't you get that sense? "Won't you speak to me? Don't you know I have the power to free you or to crucify you?" Now remember, Pilate is convinced that Jesus has done nothing deserving of death. Throughout this whole episode, he is saying over and over, "I think he's innocent. I find no fault in this man." But Jesus isn't helping his own case any. Pilate is saying, "Hey, give me something I can use here. You're not going to speak to me?" I think there's certainly some anger and frustration in his voice. Maybe it was said a bit as a threat, trying to intimidate Jesus to give an answer. But I think Warren Wiersbe probably got to the crux of the matter when he says, "Fear and anger often go together. When we are afraid we are weak, we tend to go to the other extreme and try to appear strong." And if you'll notice in that scripture reading, when the Jews said, "According to our law, this man should be put to death because he claimed to be the Son of God," what was Pilate's reaction? It says that he became all the more fearful. He's afraid. He didn't want anything to do with this. Not because he believed in Jesus in the way we would think. But they were very superstitious and they believed in the gods, and he didn't want to anger any of them. And he realized there was something wrong here. This was not just the way it appeared on the surface. And so the scripture itself says he was afraid. And yes, oftentimes when we're afraid and we don't want to show it, we go to the other extreme and try to appear strong. I think that's probably what Pilate was getting at. What's interesting, though, is for all the power Pilate thought he had, he didn't use it. How many times in this passage does Pilate say, "I find no fault in him, I think he's innocent, he doesn't deserve death," and yet, why didn't he release him? He says to Jesus, "I have the power to free you." Okay, Pilate, why don't you? See, even the power that he had limits. He was living under the delusion of all of this power that he didn't even exercise himself. It was really an empty claim at best. He's already attested to Jesus' innocence 3 times, but he hasn't released him. If anything, he himself is a prisoner. He's a captive of his own fear of the Jews and the ability they've already shown to cause trouble. Earlier in this series, we've talked about how Pilate's decisions were not always popular with the Jewish people, who all hated Rome anyway. But they would send off these letters of complaint to the emperor. And somewhere between 8 and 6 weeks before Good Friday, Pilate got a letter, a very nasty worded letter from Tiberius, the emperor, saying, "Look, quit offending the Jews in their areas of religion and practice. If you don't stop, you will lose your job." So Pilate was kind of between a rock and a hard place. He was afraid that if they wrote another letter saying, "Well, we have this man who says he's king, and your governor wouldn't do anything about it," that he would probably lose his job and maybe his life. Jesus saw right through this. Look at verse 11. You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. Pilate's bragging, I have the power. And Jesus says, no, you don't. You don't have any power at all except that which has been given to you. But oh, how we live under this delusion today. We think we've got it all together. We think we've got everything under control. We can live however we please. Now, it's true, God has given us a great deal of latitude. We're going to get in a little bit later in the message about the authority we do have that He's given to every single one of us. But sometimes that goes to our head, doesn't it? Sometimes we think we're more powerful than we really are. Like Pilate, we're living under the delusion of human autonomy. Jesus spoke of a successful farmer in the Gospel of Luke. Luke chapter 12, verse 16. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Then he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and I'll build bigger ones. And there I will store my grain and my goods. I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool. This very night, your life will be demanded from you. Then who's going to get all these things you've amassed for yourself? Likewise, James warns in James chapter 4. James chapter 4, beginning in verse 13. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business and make money. Why, you don't even know what'll happen tomorrow. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast and brag, and all such boasting is evil. Anyone then who knows the good he ought to do and doesn't do it, sins. See, when we leave God out of the picture, we think we've got it all under control. We're living under the delusion of human autonomy. That classic poem that I read earlier, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. No, you're not. Not totally. God is still in control. He is ultimately the master of everyone's fate. A very prominent Christian businessman wrote an article with a rather strange title, The Art of Being a Big Shot. Among the many insightful things he wrote were these words, it is my pride that makes me independent of God. It's appealing to me to feel that I am the master of my fate, that I run my own life, call my own shots, go it alone. But that feeling is my basic dishonesty. I can't go it alone. I have to get help from other people. I can't ultimately rely on myself. I'm dependent on God for my next breath. It's dishonest of me to pretend that I'm anything but a man, small, weak, and limited. So living independent of God is really a self-delusion. It's not just a matter of pride being an unfortunate little trait and humility being an attractive little virtue. It's my inner psychological integrity that's at stake. When I am conceited, I am lying to myself about who I am. I'm pretending to be God, not man. My pride is the idolatrous worship of myself, and that is the national religion of hell. I realize that that statement might sound a little un-American. But this idea we have of rugged individualism, that we can pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, I don't need nobody but me, that kind of mentality might be very popular, but it's a delusion. We don't have it all under control. We can't determine everything by ourselves. Now, in response to Pilate's arrogant delusion, Jesus points to the delegation of human authority. Back to verse 11. Jesus said, "You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above." Pilate was bragging about his authority, but Jesus reminded him that that authority was only delegated to him by God. And even as God gave it, he can also take it away. The power is always in God's hands ultimately. And one day God would call him into account for how he exercised that authority, those privileges and responsibilities. The Bible clearly teaches that God is sovereign. He is the one ultimately in control. Daniel 4:17 proclaims, "The Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men. He is the power behind every throne." Furthermore, Paul writes in Romans 13:1, "Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority," you could read power in there if you wanted, "except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God." Now, I'm not saying that God is responsible for public elections. I'm not saying that God is responsible for those who illegitimately take control of another country, as you see throughout the world. I'm not saying that God handpicks every person that ascends into power. What he has done is created a system, a structure of government, knowing that mankind needs it. And that authority has been given by God. Now, the most wretched person on earth can assume control of a nation or nations. It's happened plenty of times in history. I don't mean to suggest at all that God can't do anything about it. God still works even through their evil choices, even through their evil acts and decisions. God is still on the throne. But let's not blame God for the decisions of men. He is not ultimately responsible for man's wickedness, yet he maintains his sovereignty. So all authority that exists comes from God. Charles Stanley makes an insightful observation. "No one exercises any authority at all in this world unless God first gives it. As children of a sovereign God, we are never victims of circumstance." Think of that. We are never victims of circumstance because God is always in control. He is the supreme authority. Now, this delegation of authority goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden. When God created Adam and Eve, he placed them in the garden. He said, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Here God has given to all of humanity some authority over his creation. Now I ask you, does this make God any less sovereign? Is he any less God because he delegates some of his authority to others? Not at all. He is still on the throne. He is still ultimately in charge, and he will bring about his will even through the free choices of men and women. God is no less sovereign. Now, we've been talking mostly here about governmental authority. I'd like to expand that a little bit, because most of us don't have that. Most of us are not elected into a position of authority. But we all have been given some authority to control the direction of our destiny, and that's called our will. Some would call it free will. Going back to the garden, when God placed Adam and Eve in the garden, he gave them the ability to choose. They could choose to follow him and obey him, or they could choose to go their own way. And we know that that's what they did. And ever since then, mankind has been trying to make it on his own, trying to do it his own way, be his own God. But it was God that gave us that power to make decisions. And we do. Someone has estimated we make 35,000 decisions every day. Yeah, a lot of them are like silly decisions, you know, but they're still choices. We're confronted with choices all the time. And God has delegated that power to us. He has given us the authority to make some choices, and those choices are meaningful. They have consequences in our lives and sometimes in the lives of others. So throughout the Scripture, we see admonitions to choose. In Deuteronomy 30, verse 19, Moses is addressing the nation of Israel as they are about to enter the promised land. He said, "This day I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses." And then he said, "Now choose life, that you and your children may live." This wasn't a matter of chance. It wasn't what side of the tracks you were born on. It wasn't your DNA. It wasn't genetics. It wasn't your environment. It's your choice. Choose life. A generation later, Joshua addressed the nation of Israel once they were in the promised land. And he said, "Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether it is the gods your forefathers served beyond the river, the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are now living. But," Joshua concluded, "as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." That was his choice. And it was a choice every single person had to make. And it's a choice every single person still has to make. We choose whom we will serve. We choose whether we enter the straight gate or the broad gate. Whether we go down the 8-lane highway to hell or that path that leads to heaven, that few find it. The choice is ours. So yes, we do have some authority, every single one of us, in the choices that we make. That doesn't make God any less sovereign. God is not held captive by the choices of men. While we are in control of our choices, I believe God is in control of the consequences of those choices. He still retains his sovereignty. And even when we make the worst choices possible, he can still bring out his will. Now, with that authority to make choices comes the accountability for those choices. And that's our final thought this morning, the determination of human accountability. Going back to John 19, look at the end of verse 11. Jesus says to Pilate, "Therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin." Jesus is speaking here of the responsibility borne by those who were involved in his arrest, his trial, and ultimately his death. Now, we might wonder, who's he talking about here? Now, it could refer to Judas. He's the one who betrayed Jesus. It could refer to Caiaphas, the high priest. He's the one that led the trial that condemned Jesus. Or it could have been the Jewish crowd that was, you know, telling Pilate to crucify him. Since he uses the word "one" and it's singular, I'm thinking it's probably not the crowd. I doubt that it was Judas, because Judas didn't hand Jesus over to Pilate. It was actually the Jewish leaders. If you want to get really specific, it's probably Caiaphas that he had in mind. But it doesn't mean that Pilate was excused from his responsibility. Yes, this one would be guilty of a greater sin, but a greater sin implies a lesser sin. And Pilate is still held accountable for what he did. Sure, he knew Jesus was not guilty of a capital crime. and yet he allowed him to be crucified. Caiaphas, having the scripture, should have known that Jesus was in fact who he claimed to be. Since he had a greater knowledge, he holds a greater accountability. And he will be held responsible for what he had done. You see, authority always leads to accountability. Jesus taught in Luke 12, verse 47 and 48, "The servant who knows his master's will and does not get ready and does not do what his master wants will be beaten with many blows. But the one who does not know and does things deserving punishment will be beaten with few blows. For everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. From the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked." We are all accountable, but our levels of accountability may vary depending on the opportunities we've had. We live in a land where we are free to practice religion, where Bibles are plentiful, where opportunities to know Jesus are bountiful. There are places in the world people don't have Bibles, they've never heard the name Jesus, they don't know. Do they still have to stand before God and give account? Yes. But who's going to have the greater accountability? Those to whom much has been given, much will be demanded. Now, if the only authority we have is the authority over ourselves, we're still accountable to God for the choices we make. The more we know about God's will and His desires, the more accountable we will be for our actions. But none of us escape that accountability entirely. God maintains His sovereignty even while delegating human authority. Free will doesn't diminish divine sovereignty at all. God is still very much in control, but He says, you are given choices and you will be held accountable for the choices you make. Pilate, you have authority. Not as much as you think you have, but you are still have the authority to choose for yourself. And with that authority comes accountability. See, in this instance, Jesus is standing before Pilate, but one day Pilate's going to stand before Jesus. And he's going to give an account, not only for what he did on Good Friday, but for his entire life. But the truth is, every one of us will give an account before God. Paul writes in Romans 14, 12, each of us will give an account of himself to God. Hebrews 4:13 adds, nothing in all creation is hidden from His sight. Everything is uncovered and laid bare before the eyes of Him to whom we must give an account. Every one of us will stand before God's judgment seat. And He's going to say, I gave you the ability to choose. What'd you do with that choice? I gave you the opportunity to put your trust in my Son, Jesus Christ. What did you do with that opportunity? Every one of us will have to give an account. I like the way Everett Harrison summed up this text. Pilate, the judge, was himself on trial all the time he was supposedly trying Jesus. And that's very true. But it's also true that every one of us is similarly going to give an account before God. We will all appear before Christ's judgment seat. We'll be held accountable for the decisions we've made in our lives. What are we going to do with Jesus? That's the decision that's going to seal our eternal fate. We all know what Pilate did. What will you do?